At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Sometimes, you know, vocabulary can be a pretty good way to figure out what is going on in this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 20th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The Marketplace word of the day today is expectations. Expectations. Used in a sentence, it might sound like this. The Federal Reserve yesterday acted in accordance with expectations and signaled its willingness to cut interest rates. The Fed's turn, although not unexpected, was a big one from where the central bank was just 6 months ago. You might remember when it was raising rates. No, we are not talking about a huge cut here, maybe a quarter of a percentage point. But as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, when you are trying to game out what a rate cut is going to mean in this economy, it is all about expectations.
Let's say the Fed does shave a quarter of a percent off interest rates at its next meeting.
Well, the biggest impact typically on lower rates would be on kind of interest-sensitive sectors of the economy, housing, autos, for example.
Thing is, Tony Rodriguez, head of fixed income strategy for Nuveen, says that the market is already expecting lower rates from the Fed. So some rates consumers and businesses pay already reflect that.
That positive impact is already in the market. So, you know, mortgage rates have come down, financing rates have come down for, you know, durable equipment, autos, et cetera.
So that cut on its own wouldn't make a huge difference for the economy.
What makes a big difference for the economy is, does that change expectations about where rates are going?
Andrew Hollenhorst, chief U.S. economist for Citigroup, says if the Fed is cutting rates in the relative near term, the question is,
might they cut more over the next few months or next few years?
In cutting rates, the Fed would be sending markets an I got your back kind of a message that is ready to act if, say, the trade war starts really slowing economic growth. Carl Tannenbaum is chief economist at Northern Trust.
But it's making a statement that the central bank stands ready to support the continuation of the expansion. And that symbolic message may actually be more powerful in the short run.
The symbolism might be more powerful economically than the cut itself. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Among those who will be watching next week's G20 meetings closely, especially the possibility of a sit-down between President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping, are the farmers of America, many of whom have taken a hit from China's retaliatory tariffs. Some growers, though, are all about the president's tariffs on Chinese imports, including Ken Christopher. He's a garlic farmer by trade. He helps run the family business, Christopher Ranch, in Gilroy, California, which, if you have ever driven through it, one sniff, and you understand why it bills itself as the garlic capital of the world. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Do me a favor and give me, just because most people probably aren't familiar with it, the general state of play in the garlic industry in this country, would you?
So about half of all the garlic consumed in the U.S. is going to be sourced from abroad, and half is going to be made here domestically. My family, we grow about a third of the total garlic consumed in America, but the other half, that's largely coming in from China, and most of that is illegally dumped Chinese garlic.
which explains the headline I saw in an article about you the other day, which was that you hope tariffs stay on forever.
Oh, this is a really exciting time for the garlic capital of the world, Gilroy, California.
Well, tell me more.
So since the 1990s, Chinese exporters have illegally dumped millions of pounds of garlic on our shores. Before they started dumping, there used to be 12 commercial garlic growers in the country. Now there's only three. So while we understand that these tariffs may not work for all farmers or even most farmers, for the garlic industry, they're critically important.
Give me the nuts and bolts. If I bought a box of California garlic, which, as I understand it, is basically Christopher Company garlic, if I bought a box of your garlic, how much would it cost me, and how much would a box of Chinese garlic cost me?
So California garlic trades for about $60 a box for a 30-pound box.
Okay.
Before the tariffs were implemented, the first round was 10% back in September. You saw Chinese garlic at about $15 a box, maybe a quarter of what we could sell for. The first 10% went into effect in September. We saw that price rise to the mid-20s. And then as we approached the 25% tariff, we saw the price increase to high 30s and low $40 range. So little by little, these tariffs are really having an incredible effect.
So if you had your druthers, I mean, I was making light of it before, but if you had your druthers, these tariffs would stay on for a good long while.
We would hope so, because it's been a 25-year fight between my family and a series of Chinese exporters.
Who have been, in your estimation, and actually have been found by the government to be dumping Chinese garlic into this country, right?
Oh, yeah. Customs, Homeland Security, the U.S. Department of Commerce, the U.S. Trade Representative, they've all identified them.
On the theory that farmers on whatever crop have at least a little bit in common, what do you say to the soybean farmers and those, you know, the hog farmers who are getting whacked by these tariffs?
Yeah, I mean, my family's heart goes out to them. But there's a much larger narrative to the tariff conversation, because it's not only garlic that's benefiting from the tariff. Honey farmers, crawfish farmers, they're among the few that are greatly benefiting.
With all the twists and turns that American trade policy has taken in the last two-something years, 18 months maybe, what happens if you wake up tomorrow morning and there's a tweet from the president that says, President Xi and I have made a deal, everything's fine, tariffs are going away?
Yeah, we understand that tariffs are probably not a long-term solution, and in the broader macroeconomic sense of the country, they're not great for us. But it's our hope that in the end, once there's a resolution or an agreement, that there will actually be enforcement of existing law on our ports. And when that happens, it'll go a long way to stopping this fraudulent activity.
Give me the nuts and bolts on your company, would you, Mr. Christopher? How many people, how much garlic do you sell, all that stuff?
Sure thing. We are Gilroy's largest employer. We have 1,000 full-time employees, and we proudly offer one of the nation's highest corporate minimum wages. So with these tariffs, that could mean increased demand for California garlic, which means more jobs, higher wages, more investments in infrastructure, and a lot of economic activity.
The promise that the president has basically been making, right?
Essentially, yes.
Ken Christopher, he's the executive vice president of the family's company, Christopher Ranch, up in Gilroy, California. Mr. Christopher, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy.
On Wall Street today, well, let's see. There is shooting in the Strait of Hormuz. The White House is making noises about demoting the chairman of the Fed. And yet, there are those expectations of an interest rate cut that Tracy was telling us about. So which way do you think things went, We'll tell you when we do the numbers. There's a bill headed to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo that, if he signs it as expected, is going to put the state on the hook for some pretty aggressive climate goals. Net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. That news comes a day after the Trump administration finalized its rollback of the Obama-era Clean Power Plan, which had obliged states to cut their emissions by about a third. It's gone now. So, with that as context, Marketplace's Ben Bradford explains that New York's plan does come with a whole lot of unknowns.
Let's start with the big unknown. The last sentence of the bill's summary reads, fiscal implications to be determined. The bill's author, Democratic State Senator Todd Kominsky, describes it this way.
Much in the same way President Kennedy talked about getting to the moon. You know, he knew we had the ability to do it, but he couldn't have told you how.
This moonshot would entail not just replacing fossil fuel power plants with zero emission alternatives, but phasing out gas heating and gasoline-powered cars. It means a radical overhaul of infrastructure in a state not exactly known for it, where 80% of energy transmission equipment predates the 1980s.
It will certainly be challenging.
NYU energy law professor Danielle Spiegelfeld says it's taken the state almost two decades to cut emissions 8% below 1990 levels.
We would have to increase by an order of magnitude the rate at which we are decarbonizing the grid.
Industries that can't fully decarbonize could pay for some offsets, like funding solar projects. Greg Barilla at the National Federation of Independent Business says the unknowns could sink small companies.
They're really worried about the cost of their energy, the cost of retrofitting their facilities, the cost of purchasing a new vehicle fleet.
Unlike other moonshots, Columbia University energy law professor Michael Girard says this measure does not allow for the possibility of failure.
Citizens can sue if the government is not doing the job. So it's the toughest law in the country.
Girard says despite those unknowns, failing to curb climate change has its own costs. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Raise your hand if you think healthcare is going to be a thing in the 2020 campaign. Those of you with your hands up, go to the head of the class, of course. And on the way, study up on this, would you? The consulting and services firm PwC says American companies are going to spend 6% more on employee healthcare next year. Marketplace's Erica Barris tells us why and what those companies figure they can do about it.
There are a few reasons why the cost of healthcare is rising, according to PwC. More people are suffering from chronic illnesses like diabetes and heart disease. More are seeking mental health treatment as the stigma falls away. And says Julian Reif, finance professor at the University of Illinois.
Arguably, the biggest reason is that there has been a lot of advances in medical technology, and medical technology is very expensive.
Like new specialty drugs, they now make up more than 40% of overall employer drug spending. To try to curb those costs, employers are negotiating prices directly with hospitals. Some are opening on-site clinics. 38% of large employers have those now. And, says Ben Isger with PwC's Health Research Institute, some big companies are partnering directly with existing healthcare systems to staff those clinics.
Otherwise, this could become a very adversarial relationship. So you could see some health systems say, hey, this is competition. You're actually taking away people that I used to serve, and you're really creating your own system over here off to the side.
And employers are creating more wellness programs to encourage healthy behavior. Sarah Collins with think tank The Commonwealth Fund says that's all fine and good, but
I think that workers tend to be the major bearers of these costs. And efforts like that might reduce people's use of care, but we know from the research that the use of care is not where the problem is.
The problem, she says, is the price. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
One of the services we provide here at Marketplace is to explain the strange ways that money affects the way we behave. To that end, a big study just out in the journal Science looked at what people would do with a lost wallet. To the researchers' surprise, the more cash in said wallet, the more likely people were to try to get back to its rightful owner. Marketplace's Jack Stewart gets to the bottom of this one.
Researchers in 355 cities in 40 countries pretended to find a wallet and then hand it in to a bank, a hotel, or another public place. Something most of us can probably relate to. I'm in downtown Los Angeles. Let's see what people here think. If you lost a wallet and you had cash in it, would you expect to get that back?
Please, in this day and age, never.
I've had it where they returned it without the cash, but my credit card, driver license were there. And I've had it returned complete with cash and everything.
My sister has lost a wallet. And when we got it back, she did get everything but her cash back. So that didn't feel that good.
That was Nikki Charles, Daniel Rodriguez, and Sandra Ramos. And this is Alan Cohn at the University of Michigan. He's behind the study.
So far, no, I've been lucky. I haven't lost my wallet.
He wanted to investigate honesty. So rather than just leave wallets on the street, he ran a controlled experiment, having them handed in to unsuspecting workers at various institutions with either no cash or the equivalent of $13 or $94 inside.
We thought that the higher the financial incentive to steal, also the more dishonest people will behave. But the opposite was the case.
Although the likelihood of people returning the wallet varied a lot by country, the pattern of people being more honest when there was more money was almost universal. He sees two reasons. People do care about others, but they also like to feel good about themselves. Shaul Shalvi at the Amsterdam School of Economics reviewed the study.
One thing that we know from, I would say, a decade plus of work on human honesty is that people lie to benefit themselves, but not so much. So they restrict the amount of their lying.
So maybe we don't have to be so cynical. And maybe it's a good idea to put your contact details in your wallet just in case. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So yes, this is Innovate or Die.
Wow, it's tough in the berry business, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials finished the session up 0.9%, 249 points, 26,753. The S&P 500 also 0.9% to the good, 27 points, 29.54. The NASDAQ up 0.8%, 64 points, 8,051 there. Today was Slack's first day as a public company, and the alert sound for the day was ka-ching. The message application company rose 48.5%, finished the session with a market cap of $23.1 billion, shares at $38 a whack. Here's a recipe for a good day in oil stocks. Start with a drone being shot down in the Middle East. Add some bellicose language from President Trump. The price of oil jumps around 5%. Oil stocks followed suit. Exploration and production company Noble Energy up 6.1%. Refiner Holly Frontier gained 5.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace turned 30 this year, and to celebrate, we are going back to the 1980s. Check out our new thank you gifts that you can choose from when you become a Marketplace investor. Your donation, big or small, will help us keep bringing you news and information you trust for years to come. So please donate today at marketplace.org.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We've got a new podcast out around this part. It's called This is Uncomfortable, stories about life and how money messes with it, because money makes things awkward, right? Like crying in pursuit of it, because crying at work does happen. A survey not too long ago showed 48% of American workers, almost half of us, have cried on the job. The host of This is Uncomfortable, Rima Kreis, has the story of a woman who became a reluctant crier.
For a lot of people, their first experience crying at work happens when they're young and early in their careers. That's the case for Kelly O'Neill. She's 23 and has a job writing funny ads for a marketing agency in Chicago.
There's this feeling that, like, I always have to be on, I always have to be performing, and just the fear of, you know, messing up, or the fear of looking like a little girl in, like, a boy's world, because I put, you know, so much pressure on myself. I'm the only woman at this office.
The only?
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's a small office, but yeah, there's about 12 of us.
Kelly had only been on the job for 3 days when the company held a big meeting to introduce her to the clients, like kind of onboarding.
Like people are sitting on like bean bags or like just like with their feet on the table. So like it seemed very casual, but it felt very high stakes.
She knew the chill vibe was just a corporate illusion, a way to convince the clients who had video conferenced in that this was a super fun, hip place to do business with. Yeah, Kelly did not feel chill.
I was trying to still make a good first impression, so I was wearing like my nicest pair of pants from Express. And I remember feeling like extremely constricted. It was like getting hard to breathe a little bit almost.
The meeting started, and almost immediately, Kelly lost track of what was happening. They were talking about 6-month and 9-month growth metrics, cost per lead.
Cost per acquisition, user acquisition, WBS. That's one of the acronyms that I remember. I still, 3 months later, don't know what that acronym stands for. I was taking rapid fire notes so I could remember all of the questions that I had for a later time. But for the most part, it was a lot of, yeah, oh, totally, of course. Yeah, I can do that. No worries.
She was completely overwhelmed. After the meeting, she stayed behind in the conference room, and that's when she could feel the tears welling up.
I kind of like, you know, shuffled my papers around, pretended like I was searching for something in my bag so I could have like a few moments just to myself while everyone else was walking out, and kind of made it look like I was fixing my makeup, but was actually wiping tears from my eyes.
To deal with the constant pressure, Kelly pops into a windowless conference room a few times a week and just has a little cry. She's terrified at the idea that anyone will catch on.
I will try to be very self-assured, or if somebody does notice that I got teary-eyed, I'll make a joke of it and be like, yeah, like, what a brat, or like, what a baby, like, I can't believe that happened.
Why do you feel like you have to say those things?
I feel like the vulnerability that comes from somebody seeing you cry or admitting that you cried is just not something that I can afford when I work with, you know, all these like powerful men who, when they have a difficult client or when they're faced with something that they can't handle, like it seems like they just swear about it and like move on or you know, bang on their desk a little bit and then get to work. So
do a manly thing.
Yeah, the fact that I handle it in such a, you know, emotional or juvenile way or whatever, you know, I can't afford that perception of me.
Kelly is right to be cautious. A 2017 study rated people's reactions to women crying at work and found that, at best, they were viewed neutrally, but more often considered weak, unprofessional, or even manipulative. Kimberly Elsbach is a professor from UC Davis and one of the study's authors. I asked her, okay, well, what about men? And she says when guys cry at work, people are far more likely to assume it's due to an extreme circumstance. But it's all still uncomfortable.
People's initial reaction to crying is almost always one of helping. So they want to help, but at work, they don't know how to help.
And how do people feel about not knowing how to help?
Well, there's two major reactions. One is just an incredible discomfort. And then it's very interesting. That discomfort moves into annoyance and even anger at the crier for making them feel uncomfortable.
Her advice to folks if they see someone cry? It is not a big deal. Just a normal expression of emotion, like Kelly feeling overwhelmed.
Hopefully, slowly over time, people will have a broader perception of what a professional worker is and what emotional expression means.
And until then, just make sure you've got a box of Kleenex nearby. I'm Rima Khres for Marketplace's new podcast, This is Uncomfortable.
You can subscribe to This is Uncomfortable. Come on, just subscribe, hook us up. You can do it wherever the finest podcasts are available. We didn't plan for this to become an agriculture show, but garlic has given way to strawberries in the program today, specifically a new kind of strawberry from the berry and fruit company Driscoll's. We got the CEO of the company, Soren Bjorn, into a studio to ask the obvious question. Mr. Bjorn, welcome to the program, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
So I will tell you, I have three of your new berries here in the studio with me, and they smell spectacular. I will taste a little later. But the first thing I want to know is, why did you feel the need to invent a new berry?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, each year we develop about 125,000 new strawberry varieties.
Really?
And we're mostly just trying to improve on the strawberry varieties we have.
Wow.
But every now and then, we get something that's a little different.
Right. And so what makes this one different? Because I have to tell you, just looking at it, if I were walking by this in a supermarket, I will tell you it's a pale pinkish looking thing. There is a vague smell of peach coming off it. But if I was just walking by in a supermarket, I would say it's not quite ripe, actually. It's a little bit pale.
That's right. And so we've been using this white strawberry. And yes, there is such a thing as white strawberries. And they have incredible flavor. And we've mostly been using those to develop better flavored varieties. But every now and then, we get these pink strawberries, and we've been trying to figure out what exactly to do with them.
So these things are, just to be clear here, they're called rosé berries, but they are alcohol-free. I will back away from the microphone, take a quick nibble, and then I want to ask you about sort of the berry business today. Oh, yeah. Oh, look, and the fruit is the meat is white, too.
That's very correct.
Talk to me for a second about, I guess the global berry business, right? Because you have said it's not rocket science, right? You just got to get stuff that tastes good into people's mouths. But it's a price point thing. It's a supply chain thing. There are a lot of dynamics going on.
Yeah. I mean, the berry business is very challenging in many ways, but it is a great place to be. I mean, berries are healthy. They are very convenient. They're now increasingly available year-round. Our biggest challenge in the world today is really labor and the availability of labor. And that's not only true in the United States, that's true in pretty much every country where we operate.
Well, so play that out a little bit. I mean, are you impacted? You know, Driscoll's came out in favor of the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada free trade agreement. That has to be sort of top of mind for you, the trade wars and how things are going.
Yeah, I mean, certainly trade with Mexico for us is very important. It's an important market to us. Most of our berries in the wintertime come from Mexico. So, you know, we want to make sure that there's free trade between our two countries. That's very important for how we make investments and make decisions. We're a lot less impacted by, you know, any trade war with China. And there are no tariffs between the U.S. and Mexico.
Huh. For now, anyway. I mean, we'll see what the president does, right?
That's correct.
You know, this idea of creating new berries, is it, in essence, innovate or die? I mean, because, right?
I think anybody needs to stay relevant with consumers. And if it just stays the same thing over and over again, you know, consumers are going to stop coming back. So yes, this is innovate or die.
Soren Bjorn, he's the president of Driscoll's, a berry grower here in California. Mr. Bjorn, thank you very much for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, how many GE engineers does it take to screw in a light bulb division? I don't know if you've seen the video that's been making its way across social media the past couple of days, a tutorial from GE Lighting, first posted back in January, it should be said, on how to reset one specific model of its smart light bulbs, bulbs that can be controlled by your phone or your voice assistant. It's that whole connected home Internet of Things thing. Anyway, what you're about to hear is a slightly condensed for time, but otherwise unaltered airing of that video.
We're going to show you how to factory reset your C by GE bulbs, which will unpair your bulb from other devices and apps that it's connected to.
Okay, I'm ready.
Start with your bulb off for at least 5 seconds.
All right.
Then turn on the bulb for 8 seconds.
Okay.
Turn off for 2 seconds.
All right.
Turn on for 8 seconds.
But
turn off for 2 seconds.
I know at this point y'all are thinking I'm just repeating things here, but I'm not.
Turn on for 8 seconds.
This is real.
Turn off for 2 seconds.
Seriously.
Turn on for 8 seconds.
It really is.
Turn off for 2 seconds. Turn on for 8 seconds.
Okay.
Turn off for 2 seconds.
Got it.
And then turn it on one last time. The bulb will flash on and off 3 times to show that the reset was successful. If it doesn't, your bulb may be running on an older version of firmware and will need to try the second factory reset process, which is...
We call GE. It's totally real. Looks like you can get a 2-pack of those bulbs, by the way, on Amazon for about $30. That and your sanity, and you're all set. All right, the Dow up a bunch today. The S&P 500 also up a bunch, which would be 0.9%. NASDAQ up 0.8%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.